This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to groovewasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. And now, on with the show.
Well, hey, what's this? The second episode this week? Yep, it sure is. Welcome to the Vinyl Guide, everyone, episode 356. My name is Nate. This is the podcast for record collectors and music nerds, and today we are speaking with Wednesday 13, and he is all hot and bothered about the new album, Horrifier, which is out today on Napalm Records, damn it, and he and I spend some time talking all about this record, the vinyl collectibles of his career, the evolution of the music business, collecting toys and serial killer memorabilia, and lots more. If you like horror punk, perhaps a cross of Marilyn Manson and the Misfits, well, you'll probably love Wednesday 13. The new album Horrifier is out now on streaming services with vinyl variants and special editions at napalmrecords.com. Oh, and hey, really quick, I get hit up by a lot of people who absolutely love the podcast and want to help us out. And hey, we love you right back. So we've set up a Patreon page, patreon.com/vinylguide, where you can go up there and help support the show. Each week, I put up extra stuff for everyone at patreon.com/vinylguide, extended episodes, commercial-free episodes, high-resolution files for you audiophile nerds. We even give early access to all interviews so you could hear it and get the jump on all that limited vinyl before the feed goes public. So there you have it. Help support the Vinyl Guide, and you get a whole bunch of extras. Patreon.com/vinylguide. Head up there now. We'll look after you. Patreon.com/vinylguide. And thanks again for the support. Oh, and hey, you pukes, subscribe and follow the Vinyl Guide podcast. Hundreds of interviews and episodes with the likes of John Dwyer of the OCs and Castleface Records, episode 331 of the Vinyl Guide, Ambrose Kenny Smith of King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard, episode 325, Matt and Ken of the Bronx stop by to talk vinyl, episode 324, Al Jorgensen of Ministry, episode 302, Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top, episode 293, Dave Lombardo of Mr. Bungle, Misfits, and Slayer, episode 243, and heaps more. Subscribe, follow, download, listen, and enjoy the Vinyl Guide podcast. All right, enough of my blabbity blab. Let's get into our conversation with Wednesday 13.
Hello, hello.
There we are. How are you, sir?
Doing good. You're my final interview of the day.
Oh, okay. Well, you saved the ugliest to last. So, the new album, Horrifier, out this week. Tell us a little bit about this LP.
This will be the ninth Wednesday 13 record in the catalog. You know, I don't even know if some bands even get up to nine albums these days. So I'm becoming classic rock at this point. It's just, you know, this is the next venture for us, the next step. It's, I think it's got a little bit of all the albums in one. There's, you know, if you've been following the career, what I do and the sounds and the, you know, I don't try to make the same record every time. I haven't made the same record every time. But on this album being the ninth one, instead of going in a completely other direction, I thought it would be time to reflect on all the different styles and things that I've done. So I went back and listened to the first album and went, all right, what's my favorite songs on this album? So those favorite songs inspired a song on this album, right? So the second album, listen, what's my favorite song on the second one? Let's write something a little more like that. So that's why you get a little bit of everything with this, everything from a, like the song Good Day to Be a Bad Guy, which sounds like more of my earlier stuff, or Murder Dolls even almost, to stuff like the song Insides Out, which is super heavy and weird and kind of fits some of the stuff we've been doing the past couple of years. So it's all over the place, but at the same time, it's all over Wednesday's place.
Were you in a bit of a reflective mood with COVID and everything? How did COVID impact the outcome of this record?
Other than just being a pain in the ass and just long waiting for everything to get done, I didn't have any good experiences with it. Not like I don't think anybody really did. I think this is the most difficult thing of us for this record was just getting everybody in one place to do it. With the restrictions of traveling, our guitarist Ramon, he spends most of his time here and overseas. So getting him over here to record, it was just a lot of work. And then studios, not wanting people to be in the studios without doing tests. And so we just decided to do this record on our own. And we took the time we had from, you know, being off tour to do it on our own. So yeah, it was a blessing and a curse in a weird way, because we did it on our own and I had all this time to sit around and think about it and change it constantly. So we have a producer, he's a guy who goes, all right, that's good enough. You got it. And I'm like, cool. But I was a producer this time. I had nobody saying it was good except for me. And I would sit there every day and go, redo it. So sometimes it would take me a week to get confident in one song. So I think I just had more time than I should have. And but I guess that wasn't a bad thing. Like I said, it was just it felt like a long wait, because I started writing this album in early 2020 and here we are releasing it at the end of 2022. So it's kind of weird.
Just following your career and your trajectory and the things you've done. I mean, the one thing that I've really noticed about what you do, I mean, you are constantly moving. You're like a shark, right? You know, and I would imagine that downtime would be particularly difficult for someone like yourself, who's used to be doing all this stuff and putting things out. And like you say, you know, sometimes good enough is fine. Let's move on. And that helps you kind of move to the next project, where this one you had to ruminate and you had to stick with it and perhaps second guess yourself. How did that play into this? How comfortable or uncomfortable was that for you?
It was, like I said, it wasn't my favorite thing. And I just started second guessing myself. And being if the whole band would have been there as a whole and recording it, like we all did our parts at separate times. Like I did all the vocals, everything by myself. I tracked it. I hit on this computer, right? I'm talking to you right now. I hit play, stop. So like I said, just not having anyone there to go, that's good enough, was weird for me. So by the time I was comfortable enough to let the band hear it, then I started getting the feedback. Well, this is great. What are you talking about? I'm like, is it good enough? You know? So I just, yeah, like I said, I thought it would be a lot easier doing it on our own, but maybe it isn't. But I also, and don't regret not, you know, I'm glad we didn't have an outside producer, because everybody was a little quirky, I think, during COVID, having 2 years off. I didn't want to bring some other quirk inside to mess with our brains. So I was like, you know what, we'll figure this out ourselves. We don't need another crazy person involved with us at the time. So let's just be our own, you know, judge and jury here.
The way I hear it is you've had a extra time, the time to be extra picky, perhaps extra difficult on yourself, but that also in some ways helps raise the bar, which in my mind, listening to the album, I hear perhaps another level of production, another level of consideration. And I think in some ways it kind of colors it a little bit. It pushes the bar higher for the quality of this album. I don't know.
Thank you. That's great to hear. Like I said, I was so close to it, it was the first album I couldn't judge without getting feedback at first. So that's what's been the most rewarding thing so far, is, you know, been doing lots of interviews and people talking to me about the record and just their reaction, the production on it, because we did it ourselves, you know, like it's so it makes me feel really good, because I know it stands up to the other records, you know, the last two records we actually had producers on the albums, and, you know, Zeus being one of the guys that did our record years ago, and him having a giant, you know, collection of credits from everything from Hatebreed, The Shadows Fall, to doing the last Murder Dolls album. That's how I got to know him. So I was always kind of scary to go, man, can we get something that's as good as what Zeus did? And I think we did. So that was definitely a rewarding thing, and I'm excited for people to hear this album in full, because right now, you know, they've just heard the singles. So mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope their reaction is like yours.
Well, maybe that's the secret sauce. Maybe you need a little bit of, you know, maybe we need more pandemics. Yeah. So
I'll pass on that. But again, this record was good though. It was, I think the other thing was the hardest part about this record was that we had just released an album that was only out for 3 months before COVID knocked everything out. So it was almost like we just made this great record. The last one, and we had all these special guests on it. Alice Cooper did the introduction on it. So
this is Necrophase, right?
Yeah. So it was all this work. And then it was like, well, that record's dead. So start writing the next one. I'm like, what? So I think that was a little bit of a low blow. But those kind of things always, I'm the kind of person, if I get knocked down, I don't lay on the ground and cry about it. I get up and I go, all right, what's the next step? If the car breaks down, I don't cry about it. Fix the fucking car. So that's how I've always been. And that's, like you said, I that's why you can see all the music I've released is because I constantly work. And you use the term shark, and it's true. You have to be a shark in this business because everybody else is. And swimming around and people going out here and there, but you gotta stay in the waters and you gotta do it. And once I got my foot in the door with Murder Dolls 20 years ago, I was never ever going to be taken out of it without someone physically taking me out of it.
Now I want to talk about that because that's a big game changer. But you've been part of the evolution of the music business to this very new interesting model, like the subscription service, Necrophasers, and again, the ways that you have to survive being a musician these days are very different than they were even 5 years ago. Talk to me a little bit about what it's like to be a professional musician in 2022. I mean, outside the pandemic, but just kind of the model and how you survive and how to create a career these days.
I wish it was an easy answer for that. I mean, for me, Murder Dolls was 2002. That was my first dip into the pro world of it. You know, I got to quit my day job and I still have not. This is my day job now. So 20 years ago, I saw, there were still cassettes being made. The last little bit of cassettes were still being made then. There was no vinyl then. Nobody was doing vinyl, it seemed like, then. But just the music scene has changed. The emo thing came in. Heavy metal came back for the new wave of American heavy metal came back through there for a while. Now it's just, I don't know. I've seen a lot of things change. Just the way bands tour, VIPs now. VIPs are part of the package. That didn't used to be you didn't get to go see Alice Cooper and meet Alice Cooper, and I remember Kiss was doing it a long time ago and charging like $1,000 to meet Kiss. And I was like, if I had $1,000, I'd pay to meet Kiss. So I started doing the VIPs back in like 2009. I was one of the first people that I knew in my area of bands that was doing that. And, and then during the pandemic, we had 2 years off. I'm like, well, how do I connect with my fans? So I did a Patreon page that I started a fan club, and I made all these different ways to watch different tiers. One of the tiers in my fan club, you got to watch this album being made. You got to watch me start with the demos. You got to watch us record. You got to hear the final thing. So my fan club they're so stoked on this record because I put their name in the album if they were part of my fan club. So they're part of the special thanks, and they got to hear it from the beginning. And that's something I never, ever got to do with my music. And to answer, like going back on that previous question, how hard was it, me being the guy that was producing it, judge and jury, the fans also got to hear these demos. So I could see their reaction to it a little bit. So that gave me a little more confidence being like, they were hearing the demo of Hideous. They were like, this song's going to be great. And I'm like, it might be. So that was something cool that I got to share with them. And the fans are, just the fan club is it's a monthly thing. So it's about 400 kids that subscribe to it. But those kids are the ones that got to see this from the beginning, which has got to be exciting for them.
Yeah, so in a way, you actually have your fans as a producer of the record.
Kind of. I mean, they didn't. I was definitely waiting for somebody to go, this sucks. But like, you know, I was sharing cool stuff with them. So that was the first ever to ever let the fans give you some feedback, especially just off a demo.
Yeah, but I think it's really interesting because the different tiers and the creative, the innovation that you're bringing to the game. Like one of the tiers of Patreon is they actually SMS you. They're actually able to text you and interact.
I have a phone that I just have just for the fan club, and I text. There's a certain amount of people that text me per month. Also, I use that. I do like a live story from the bus once a week or twice a week. I do a live show on these things. So, you know, I was even doing a comic book there for a while where I included 13 fans every month could get killed in my comic book. So I was just being clever, but there was a couple months there where I was spending 8 to 10 hours a day just working on doing fan club stuff. And I was like, this is insane. I'm making more money doing this than I am on tour, but I'm spending 10 hours a day on my phone.
Yeah.
But it was an interesting thing. I got to learn another way to survive in this, and you know, and what better way to survive than do something fun that your fans are going to be into. It wasn't hard work. It was just work. It was a lot of just constantly creative. And so, yeah, I made the best out of the COVID thing. And now that we're out of that, the fan club still goes on. You know, I just wish I had a little more time to do it, because being on tour and trying to run that the way I was doing it during COVID is pretty much impossible, because I don't have time, you know. So,
but no doubt you'll shift. You'll figure out how to make those worlds kind of work together.
Absolutely.
And it's really admirable how you've been able to kind of maneuver in those waters. Now, this show is about vinyl. It's about record collecting. It's also about collecting in general, right? And you seem to have a really good understanding of how collectors work and how they think. Are you a collector of anything?
Oh man, yes. Mainly toys. I'm a toy guy. I mean, I collect everything. more stuff than I should. You know, CDs and vinyl and stuff are one thing I collect, but that's not like a massive thing I do anymore. But mainly just vintage toys from my childhood, like everything from the G.I. Joe Real American Hero in the 80s to He-Man. I mean, I have a massive, massive collection. I could probably, hopefully one day, if I wanted to, I could probably retire off of all the toys and stuff I have. You know, I collect movies. I collect just everything from my childhood and the stuff that I didn't get as a kid. It's just, I go back, I'm on tour now. Fans find out the stuff I like. They bring me toys. Like yesterday, I got bombarded with so much cool stuff yesterday. It was overwhelming. I got like an original Flash Gordon comic magazine from the movie, which is the first movie I ever saw in a theater. So yeah, that kind of stuff is super important to me. And it keeps me young. I call it my fountain of youth, you know, and I love all that stuff, you know, so collecting's a big part of what I do.
Is there anything in your, I'll call them collections, but anything that you're missing, anything that you'd love to be able to see or find?
You know, I was talking about it, I think earlier today, you know, someone asked me, like, what's a toy that you didn't get or you had and you want again? My very first toys I ever got, I remember Christmas. I was probably four and a half years old. My first memory was the Stretch Armstrong toy they made. But they made Stretch Armstrong, and he was always the one you couldn't find in the store because he was popular. But he had this green looking monster thing that looked like the Slee Stack off Land of the Lost, which I was obsessed with. And that was the first toy I got. And when I opened it up, my parents said I screamed and I threw it back because it was a monster, you know, this big green monster. And they said I didn't play with it for about 2 or 3 weeks. And then they got it out of the closet, and I literally held it like it was my child. I slept with it every day, shortly after that, they recalled those toys because there was some chemical was inside of them. So when you stretch it out after a certain point, it would start to break, and it was toxic. So they were like, you know, yeah, get these. Don't let your kids have these. If they eat it, they could get poisoned. So of course, my monster's got bulging, you know, all the goos coming out of him. And I remember them like taking it away from me like it was a family member. I was like, we got to get rid of it. It's like, no. And over the years, going back trying to find those, I found out that all you can find now is the head and the box of that, because the body deteriorated from whatever was inside of it. It just eroded. I don't know of anyone that has one that's intact. There's been replicas, but you can still find the head and the box. And sometimes that goes for $1,800 just for the head and the box. It's ridiculous, you know? So that's the one toy I would love to have again, or at least a piece of it.
So I'm no psychologist here, Wednesday, but I would guess that experience right there of being scared and then loving this thing and then having it being taken away from you perhaps played some sort of role in developing the sort of person and artist that you are today.
Absolutely. And I've told my parents, they don't believe. And I go, you remember when you did this to me? No, we didn't do that. I'm like, yeah, it was the same thing. I remember when the Halloween series came back in part 4, I believe that was 1988. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 1988, I'm 11 years old or something. 11, 12 years old, I couldn't get into the movie theater. And I just remember sitting at home and the new Halloween came out and I couldn't go see it because my parents wouldn't take me. I couldn't get in the theater. And I just sit and just stewed and just kicked the dirt. And just, it was just like, I'm like, one day, like I was that passionate about horror movies. Like it was just my world. So, you know, when it came time to me, you know, picking up a guitar and, you know, writing music, you know, people say, you know, write what you know about. And I know about Swamp Thing and and all these movies. So it just came naturally to me. So all this stuff, all my upbringing, TV was such a big part. TV and toys.
Yeah, you better call up your parents and thank them for that trauma. You may not have a career without that sort of pain or
They know, and I'm still, it's still the same for me. Like on our tour bus right now, I brought all my retro DVDs. Like we were watching What's Happening Today. We were watching Different Strokes and WKRP in Cincinnati last night. That's just, you know, and I'm surrounded by a bunch of likewise people, so I don't feel like a weirdo. You know who I am.
Oh, I get all that. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So you've made a career out of a lot of, and I'm, you know, I mean it only in the funnest way, the creepy imagery, the shock. What shocks you? What creeps you out now?
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay, grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up. Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside, so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new. Turn a $5 used record into a $50 functioning collectible. Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seamseasy.com. That's Seems Easy with 2 Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VinylGuide10. 10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VinylGuide10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits.
So you've made a career out of a lot of, and I mean it only in the funnest way, the creepy imagery, the shock. What shocks you? What creeps you out now?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think, I mean, just, I guess I'm in league with Indiana Jones. I've never been a big fan of snakes. I like snakes, but I just don't want them anywhere near me. Maybe between a piece of glass, that's fine. It was weird. I was watching Indiana Jones the other day, and like, I realized all the little horrors they use, like the spiders, the spider webs, the snakes, little things like that. That still bothers me. And they don't do that in movies anymore, rats and things like that. That was always, when I find myself watching these old movies again, that still creeps me out. Serial killer stuff doesn't really bother me. I know that's pretty popular these days. I was telling someone earlier today, they're like, serial killer stuff is like number one in everything now. I'm like, I've been reading about this stuff since I was a teenager, I had John Wayne Gacy books and all this stuff. So all that's, played a, I'm the perfect soundtrack for for people that, that like a lot of that stuff. Someone was, if they only knew of Wednesday 13, like I am the soundtrack to this stuff.
It's a big collectability groups out there. What do they call it? Murderabilia or something? I knew this one guy, he had a collection of hair. And he had like Charles Manson's hair and different things. Now, suffice to say, I didn't to give this guy my address or anything. But do you have any of that murder memorabilia? Anything super creepy?
I did. I was the owner of 8 original John Wayne Gacy paintings from prison for a while. They were pretty much kind of given to me as someone going, I can't have this in my house anymore. It's too creepy. Well, I'll take it. Then I got it in my house and went, I don't know if I want this in here. I had eight different drawings. I had to research it to even find out, value of it or what is what. Some people, like, you really can't even, like, I'm just speaking of the John Wayne Gacy stuff that I know about. Like I had 8 different pictures, but he had supposedly done 20 of those. And then some people go, well, we only did 10 of those. Some of the family people had bought a lot of that stuff back and started burning it, so people couldn't have it. It seems to be a big thing right now. And just the other day, someone at one of my VIPs gave me a fork and said, this is a replica of a mold from a fork from Jeffrey Dahmer's house.
Okay,
so I got that this week. So that's the only weird thing I've got right now, that if to compare to that. But like, I got rid of those Gacy paintings years ago. I just didn't want that mojo around me. It was kind of fun to have for a bit, to go, hey, I've got these Gacy paintings. I don't have any more of that, but I'm surprised to see where it goes. Like, it's amazing how that type of is now the number one. There's someone told me there's like murder serial killer podcasts that are like huge, and I'm like, really?
Yeah, extraordinary. Yeah.
I had no idea. I've just, that's always been stuff I've been interested in or fascinated with, just to see how someone could go to that morbid extreme. Definitely not influence on me.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just always found that fascinating. And now it's like, it's your top 10, Jeffrey Dahmer's number one on Netflix right now. I had the Jeffrey Dahmer comic book back in 90, 91, so there was lots of weird stuff. And I got a feeling it's only going to get weirder.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't see us becoming more healthy as a species. So in terms of your ability to kind of tap into your audience's desire to collect and things like that. You know, I know you do limited vinyl pressings, different things like that. What's the weirdest thing you've ever put on the merch table?
Weirdest thing, during COVID, I got, you know, doing the fan club stuff. I was doing a lot of different things. I was working with a company, did a lot of like little one-off action figures, like one of 100. But the weirdest thing we made was I made the slime from back when I was a kid. He-Man had slime. I want to say the Ghostbusters had the slime, little cups of slime. So I made slime and put worms in it. So they were called necro worms. And I sold a little cup of slime and worms to kids the first year of the pandemic. So that was pretty weird. I also made a Wednesday 13 plastic knife that I used on stage. So yeah, man, if I can get it made, I will get it made. I am, you know, I grew up in that age of collecting and you know, and with vinyl and stuff, you know, Kiss and Alice Cooper putting all the cool stuff in their records, like School's Out and A Pair of Panties, the Love Gun, Alice Cooper's Muscle of Love coming in a piece of cardboard that's like contains one muscle of love. Those things are fun. So with this album coming out this week, we offered a Ouija board with the vinyl. So that's a first for me too. So there seems to be no end. If it's weird and possible to make, I will eventually have it in the merch. This has been that comes out on Friday. I haven't seen the actual physical what it looks like or how it's packaged, but I think it comes folded up in the vinyl, and then the plastic on the top will have the little planchet thing that just kind of sets on the top of it. I think that's how it's being packaged.
What is the rarest record?
Oh, wow.
Is that one already sold out? Is that the one on Napalm Records? Or was it a collectible rare? The one that the fans are like, you know, batshit to try to find one.
Most of my stuff's available. It's mainly my projects I did early on. Before Murder Dolls, my Frankenstein Drag Queen band had released 6 albums and I don't even know how many different little 45s, singles with different artwork, different color. Those are ones a lot of people try to find because there's been so many reprints of it. And so yeah, when I do these VIPs and I'm signing stuff, you know, people will bring a stack of stuff to me. Like the other day I signed a cassette of my first album. I didn't even know there was one, you know, from 2005. So I'm even finding stuff sometimes I haven't seen. So I don't know what the rarest thing is, but it seems like the older pre-Murder Doll stuff is the stuff people, the really diehards want to try to find.
Those 7 inches and you released, I want to say 7 or 8 of them around 2000, 2001. Mm-hmm. The Hello Hooray, there's the Split with the Spook. Those are going quite crazy these days, several hundred bucks.
Really? Wow.
Around that time, now that's the time where there wasn't much vinyl out there, but you like doubled down on a format that was dead at the time. Do you remember your thinking about that at the time?
Well, the reason I was into that world is because I was really close with a good friend of mine in North Carolina. The band Anti-Scene, they're familiar with, probably most known with Gigi Allen. And they have been a band since 1983. So when I first started my Frankenstein Drag Queen band, the front guy of Anti-Scene, Jeff Clayton, was helping me with, you know, go to this studio and record and go over here to get this made. And I'm like, and he goes, well, this is where I got mine made. And this is my new 7-inch. I'm like, what is this? He goes, well, yeah, we team up with this band overseas and do a split. I'm like, that's a cool idea. And then once I got into that league with those guys and they were taking us out and doing shows and stuff, I got familiar in their world. So basically all of their contacts were like, hey, we want to do a Frankenstein Drag Queen split with so it was a lot of just, he was definitely a big help and helping us get those connections. And then we signed that deal with the people like you Records, and then they put out the vinyl and there's a box set. So maybe the box set is another one of the rarest things, but there was only 2,500 of each of those, a different one in Europe and a different one in the US. So they have to be scattered now. You know, I have one myself of each.
Right. Okay. It's very interesting. Early in your career, Frankenstein drag queens from Planet 13. I mean, you seem to have not done anything halfway from day one. You know, I mean, it seems that you were all in on this career from very early on. Talk to me a little bit about making that leap so early on.
Well, it was, you know, I got out of high school in 1995. I was in a band at the time that band kind of turned into what would be Frankenstein Drag Queens. But I was doing that band from like 1992 up until then. I was getting out of school. I was like, I had to go get a job that summer, and I went, this fucking sucks. I don't want to do this. I want to, you know, so, you know, just always I was at my day job, you know, whatever I was doing, I delivered furniture for a while. I worked at Kmart for a couple of years. And every day at work, I was trying to find a way to get out of here, you know, like, some way, you know, and when I got that call from Joey about Murder Dolls, I was like, I can't not do this. This is an opportunity for me to do that.
Yeah. For people who may not know what we're talking about here, Joey Jordanson of Slipknot makes a call to you. He discovered your Frankenstein drag queens. Yeah.
Well, it was him. And, you know, he had his band in Des Moines called The Rejects, and the front guy of the band, he was a big fan of Frankenstein drag queens. And I think he's probably the one that turned Joey on to Frankenstein drag queens. And then, at the time we had, the guy Tripp, who was playing in the band, he and I had met a couple years before that. So so it was, you know, he liked the music as well, because all that music ended up being that first Murder Dolls album, right. most of those songs. So, you know, Joey was, you know, I remember him calling me on the phone, and just, you know, that was back when you had your home line, no cell phone. And he's like, he's like, yeah, I'm in Slipknot. And I went, well, which guy are you? There's like 20 of you. And he's like, I'm the cool looking guy. And I'm like, oh, okay. So we just started talking, and it was just an instant chemistry. And that's what happened. But luckily, like you said, I started off Frankenstein Drag Queens. It had to be big and better than anything I'd done before, and at that point it was. And each record got bigger and better production and more thought into it, and you know, I was ready to keep that band going, until I got the Murder Dolls thing, and then that changed my world.
Now, the material for Beyond the Valley of the Murder Dolls, was that already written when you joined, or in what shape were the songs when you
well, I mean, basically, I mean, I'd have to look at the track listing on it, but every song on that album, with the exception of three songs, were all Frankenstein drag queen songs. Nothing was changed. Joey just literally heard this raw sound with those albums and said, I'm going to produce this. I'm going to put real crazy drums on it. We're going to make this big. And that's what he did. So, I mean, everything, Love at First Fright, Kill Miss America, Dead in Hollywood, Twist My Sister, all those are on the first two Frankenstein drag queen albums. And then it was, the music was done. I just, you know, Joey just wanted to put his hands on it and produce it, and that's the difference from those records. You know, there's a couple of songs on it that were, I think, previously were Joey's, when it was called The Rejects. For the most part, that record is 95% what I brought from Frankenstein Drag Queens.
Okay. So now, Beyond the Valley of the Murder Dolls only issued once on vinyl in 2016. Yes. That's super collectible. That's a couple $100 if you could find one. Yes. Women and Children Last, which is perhaps my favorite album title of all time. That's never been on vinyl.
Not yet.
Yeah. Okay.
Unfortunately, there's a saboteur in the Murder Dolls camp that has taken the Murder Dolls name and is now releasing a bunch of vinyl that you're going to start seeing. And that's up for pre-order right now without my approval. Hopefully I can stop this before they put their hands on, because they're not getting any of my input on it. And like I said, that's my music. Mm-hmm. And like I said, there's a ex touring member who's taken upon himself to steal the Murder Doll trademark and is now trying to run Murder Dolls as if it's his band. It's going to be a weird thing, because I know kids are going to buy this vinyl and not have any idea that I didn't approve of it. And that probably in the next, when they become available, right now they're just on pre-order, but it's a weird situation. I've fallen into one of those bands fighting over a band name, but
oh, you know, no.
Yeah. But the dumbest thing is the guy trying to take, or that took the name, was just, there was nobody else but Joey and I that did everything. So it's almost like, you know, it'd be like if Gilby Clark said, "Hey, Axel, I'm putting out a Use Your Illusion, my own version of it." Oh, you are? It's the dumbest thing. That's the only comparison I could give that would maybe make sense to people. So that's right. Something I've in this 20 years of, I didn't think I'd be dealing with, that's happening right now.
Oh, well, you can't get through. You didn't think you're going to get through totally unscathed, I guess.
No. Again, nothing's going to, all this is just a bump in the road. I've dealt with worse things. So do
you have access to all your masters? Like, I mean, the works that you've done, back to Frankenstein, Drag Queens, all your solo stuff. Do you have all the masters?
No, some stuff is what you hear on the recordings. You're never going to hear again, because there is no master. It's just gone. The Frankenstein Drag Queen stuff, I think I have almost all of those masters now, whether they're in great shape. They're in North Carolina in a storage space right now. So they're just massive. They're just giant reel-to-reel things, you know. Right. So for, you know, it's just, it's a lot of stuff, but the last few records are the only thing that I have the masters to. And I'm sure Women and Children Last, I'm sure Zeus has the masters for that, because he produced that album. So I'm sure I know he still has that.
Okay.
So yeah, some stuff is lost, and some stuff, the masters are still there for, you know, for any remastering or remixing or anything.
All right. Well, you better get those taken care of. You don't want them. I mean, I think there's a hurricane happening right now. You better stay away from that storage space. Okay. Just finishing up on the Murder Dolls. Was there any music for album number 3? Any demos created? Anything that was kind of partway done when Joey and Ben passed?
Well, basically the Women and Children Last record was a fresh beginning. It was Joey and I, and we parted ways with the original touring lineup. So at that point, you know, we got a new lineup, which most of that lineup now is my band that I tour with. So the only songwriters in Murder Dolls was Joey and I. There was nobody else. As far as ideas, I mean, I spoke with Joey in 2018. I spoke with him 2020, and I spoke with him a month before he passed away. And we had both said, yeah, we want to do Murder Dolls again. We didn't have a timeline on it, but the idea of it. And that song, Good Day to Be a Bad Guy, on my new record, was the first song that I wrote that was going to be presented as new Murder Doll. That's why it has that sound to it. And we had all talked about doing it. And unfortunately, he passed away in July last year. And that's kind of where, you know, the band should have been done with that. And like I said, now there's a guy trying to profit off of his death and get a cash grab, and it fucking sucks.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for the update on that. Look, I do want to be respectful of your time. Going through your solo albums, there's a lot of them that, are not available on vinyl. Mm-hmm. Are you thinking at some point things like Calling All Corpses, Spook and Destroy, The Dixie Dead, you think we'll see those on vinyl at some point?
They're
some
on
point?
Vinyl right now. They're on Napalm Records. All the ones you just named, only two you cannot get is Transylvania and Fang Bang, the first two. Skeletons, even my side project, Gunfire 76. Napalm Records picked those up 2 years ago when I was still signed to Nuclear Blast. So right. They have most of the catalog. I think everything is on vinyl except for the first two albums. And that's because that was on Roadrunner Records and the other one was on Ryko Disc.
Right.
So, I'm still in touch with the people I dealt with both of those labels. I'm sure it's a way to do it and get it done. I just don't know if that's something they were having on the top of their list to get. I know there's a demand for it. I think everything else is available on vinyl. But now there's two versions. There's my original versions and now there's the Napalm version. So collectors are just, it's a lot. It's a lot, you know.
Well, Wednesday, thanks for joining us here on the Vinyl Guide. Want to just draw everyone's attention to Wednesday 13's new album, Horrifier. It is out now. Make sure you check out Napalm Records. There are several vinyl pressings available. Hop up on the website to see it. I'll put a link in this episode page for that. And if you look at the history of Wednesday 13 and the projects he's been involved in, all this vinyl becomes super collectible. So get it while you can, especially early on, while it's a reasonable price, because at some point it's going to start creeping up and up and up. And then you're going to be kicking yourself because you didn't get it early on. So again, Horrifier, Wednesday 13. It's out now. And again, Wednesday, thank you so much for joining us here on The Vinyl Guy.
Thank you for having me, man. Great chat.
Alrighty, there you have it, Mr. Wednesday 13 here on the Vinyl Guide. New album, Horrifier, is out now. Listen to it on streaming services, and you can order vinyl variants at napalmrecords.com. And that's it for this episode of the Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Put them on Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter, regram them on Instagram, do all that stuff. Tell your friends about the Vinyl Guide. That is hugely helpful. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of the Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.